Chapter 1. I meet Sir Henry Curtis. It is a curious thing that at my age 55 last birthday I should find myself taking up a pen to try to write a history. I wonder what sort of a history it will be when I have finished it, if ever I come to the end of the trip. I have done a good many things in my life, which seems a long one to me, owing to my having begun work so young, perhaps. At an age when other boys are at school I was earning my living as a trader in the old colony. I have been trading, hunting, fighting, or mining ever since. And yet it is only 8 months ago that I made my pile. It is a big pile now that I have got it. I don't yet know how big, but I do not think I would go through the last 15 or 16 months again for it. No, not if I knew that I should come out safe at the end, pile and all. But then I am a timid man, and dislike violence. Moreover, I am almost sick of adventure. I wonder why I am going to write this book. It is not in my line. I am not a literary man, though very devoted to the Old Testament and also to the Ingoldsby legends. Let me try to set down my reasons, just to see if I have any. First reason, because Sir Henry Curtis and Captain John Good asked me. Second reason, because I am laid up here at Durban with the pain in my left leg. Ever since that confounded lion got hold of me I have been liable to this trouble, and being rather bad just now, it makes me limp more than ever. There must be some poison in a lion's teeth, otherwise how is it that when your wounds are healed they break out again? Generally, mark you, at the same time of year that you got your mauling? It is a hard thing when one has shot 65 lions or more, as I have in the course of my life, that the 66th should chew your leg like a quid of tobacco. It breaks the routine of the thing, and putting other considerations aside, I am an orderly man and don't like that. This is, by the way. Third reason, because I want my boy Harry, who is over there at the hospital in London studying to become a doctor, to have something to amuse him and keep him out of mischief for a week or so. Hospital work must sometimes pall and grow rather dull, for even of cutting up dead bodies there may come satiety, and as this history will not be dull, whatever else it may be, it will put a little life into things for a day or two while Harry is reading of our adventures. Fourth reason and last, because I am going to tell the strangest story that I remember. It may seem a queer thing to say, especially considering that there is no woman in it except Fulata. Stop, though. There is Gagaula, if she was a woman, and not a fiend. But she was 100 at least, and therefore not marriageable, so I don't count her. At any rate, I can safely say that there is not _petticoat_ in the whole history. Well, I had better come to the oak. It is a stiff place, and I feel as though I were bogged up to the axle. But, _sutures_, as the boars say, I am sure I don't know how they spell it softly does it. A strong team will come through at last, that is, if they are not too poor. You can never do anything with poor oxen. Now to make a start. I, Alan Quatermain, of Durban, natal, gentleman, make oath and say that's how I headed my deposition before the magistrate about poor Kiva's and Vent Vogel's sad deaths, but somehow it doesn't seem quite the right way to begin a book. And, besides, am I a gentleman? What is a gentleman? I don't quite know, and yet I have had to do with niggers. No, I will scratch out that word niggers, for I do not like it. I've known natives who _, and so you will say, Harry, my boy, before you have done with this tale, and I have known mean whites with lots of money and fresh out from home, too, who _or not_. At any rate, I was born a gentleman, though I have been nothing but a poor traveling trader and hunter all my life. Whether I have remained so I know not, you must judge of that. Heaven knows I've tried. I have killed many men in my time, yet I have never slain wantonly or stained my hand in innocent blood, but only in self-defense. The Almighty gave us our lives, and I suppose He meant us to defend them. At least I have always acted on that, and I hope it will not be brought up against me when my clock strikes. There, there, it is a cruel and a wicked world, and for a timid man I have been mixed up in a great deal of fighting. I cannot tell the rights of it, but at any rate I have never stolen, though once I cheated a Kaffir out of a herd of cattle. But then he had done me a dirty turn, and it has troubled me ever since into the bargain. Well, it is 18 months or so ago since first I met Sir Henry Curtis and Captain Good. It was in this way. I had been up elephant hunting beyond Bamangwato, and had met with bad luck. Everything went wrong that trip, and to top up with I got the fever badly. So soon as I was well enough I trekked down to the diamond fields, sold such ivory as I had, together with my wagon and oxen, discharged my hunters, and took the post cart to the Cape. After spending a week in Cape Town, finding that they overcharged me at the hotel, and having seen everything there was to see, including the botanical gardens, which seemed to me likely to confer a great benefit on the country, and the new houses of Parliament, which I expect will do nothing of the sort, I determine to go back to Natal by the underscore Dunkeld underscore, then lying at the docks waiting for the underscore Edinburgh Castle underscore due in from England. I took my berth and went aboard, and that afternoon the Natal passengers from the underscore Edinburgh Castle underscore transhipped, and we weighed and put to sea. Among these passengers who came on board were two who excited my curiosity. One, a gentleman of about 30, was perhaps the biggest chested and longest armed man I ever saw. He had yellow hair, a thick yellow beard, clear-cut features, and large gray eyes set deep in his head. I never saw a finer looking man, and somehow he reminded me of an ancient Dane. Not that I know much of ancient Danes, though I knew a modern Dane who did me out of £10, but I remember once seeing a picture of some of those gentry, who, I take it, were a kind of white Zulus. They were drinking out of big horns, and their long hair hung down their backs. As I looked at my friend standing there by the companion ladder, I thought that if he only let his grow a little, put one of those chain shirts onto his great shoulders, and took hold of a battle axe and a horn mug, he might have sat as a model for that picture. And by the way, it is a curious thing, and just shows how the blood will out, I discovered afterwards that Sir Henry Curtis, for that was the big man's name, is of Danish blood. He also reminded me strongly of somebody else, but at the time I could not remember who it was. The other man, who stood talking to Sir Henry, was stout and dark, and of quite a different cut. I suspected at once that he was a naval officer. I don't know why, but it is difficult to mistake a navy man. I have gone shooting trips with several of them in the course of my life, and they have always proved themselves the best and bravest and nicest fellows I ever met, though sadly given, some of them, to the use of profane language. I asked a page or two back, "What is a gentleman?" I'll answer the question now. A Royal Naval Officer is, in a general sort of way, though of course there may be a black sheep among them here and there. I fancy it is just the wide seas and the breath of God's winds that wash their hearts and blow the bitterness out of their minds and make them what men ought to be. Well, to return, I proved right again. I ascertained that the dark man underscore was underscore a naval officer, a lieutenant of 31, who, after 17 years' service, had been turned out of Her Majesty's employ with the barren honor of a commander's rank, because it was impossible that he should be promoted. This is what people who serve the Queen have to expect, to be shot out into the cold world to find a living just when they are beginning really to understand their work, and to reach the prime of life. I suppose they don't mind it, but for my own part I had rather earn my bread as a hunter. One's halfpence are as scarce perhaps, but you do not get so many kicks. The officer's name I found out by referring to the passengers' lists was good Captain John Good. He was broad, of medium height, dark, stout, and rather a curious man to look at. He was so very neat and so very clean-shaved, and he always wore an eyeglass in his right eye. It seemed to grow there, for it had no string, and he never took it out except to wipe it. At first I thought he used to sleep in it, but afterwards I found that this was a mistake. He put it in his trousers pocket when he went to bed, together with his false teeth, of which he had two beautiful sets that, my own being none of the best, have often caused me to break the 10th commandment. But I am anticipating. Soon after we had got under way, evening closed in, and brought with it very dirty weather. A keen breeze sprung up off land, and a kind of aggravated Scotch mist soon drove everybody from the deck. As for the underscore Dunkeld underscore, she is a flat-bottomed punt, and going up light as she was, she rolled very heavily. It almost seemed as though she would go right over, but she never did. It was quite impossible to walk about, so I stood near the engines where it was warm, and amused myself with watching the pendulum, which was fixed opposite to me, swinging slowly backwards and forwards as the vessel rolled, and marking the angle she touched at each lurch. "That pendulum's wrong, it is not properly weighted," suddenly said a somewhat testy voice at my shoulder. Looking round, I saw the naval officer whom I had noticed when the passengers came aboard. "Indeed, now what makes you think so?" I asked. "Think so? I don't think at all. Why, there as she righted herself after a roll, if the ship had really rolled to the degree the thing pointed to, then she would never have rolled again, that's all. But it is just like these merchant skippers, they are always so confoundedly careless." Just then the dinner bell rang, and I was not sorry, for it is a dreadful thing to have to listen to an officer of the Royal Navy when he gets onto that subject. I only know one worse thing, and that is to hear a merchant skipper express his candid opinion of officers of the Royal Navy. Captain Good and I went down to dinner together, and there we found Sir Henry Curtis already seated. He and Captain Good were placed together, and I sat opposite to them. The captain and I soon fell into talk about shooting and whatnot, he asking me many questions, for he is very inquisitive about all sorts of things, and I answering them as well as I could. Presently he got onto elephants. "Ah, sir," called out somebody who was sitting near me, "you've reached the right man for that. Hunter Quatermain should be able to tell you about elephants if anybody can." Sir Henry, who had been sitting quite quiet listening to our talk, started visibly. "Excuse me, sir," he said, leaning forward across the table, and speaking in a low deep voice, a very suitable voice, it seemed to me, to come out of those great lungs. "Excuse me, sir, but is your name Alan Quatermain?" I said that it was. The big man made no further remark, but I heard him mutter "fortunate" into his beard. Presently dinner came to an end, and as we were leaving the saloon Sir Henry strolled up and asked me if I would come into his cabin to smoke a pipe. I accepted, and he led the way to the __dunkeld__deck cabin, and a very good cabin it is. It had been two cabins, but when Sir Garnet Wolseley or one of those big swells went down the coast in the __dunkeld__, they knocked away the partition and have never put it up again. There was a sofa in the cabin, and a little table in front of it. Sir Henry sent the steward for a bottle of whiskey, and the three of us sat down and lit our pipes. "Mr. Quatermain," said Sir Henry Curtis, when the man had brought the whiskey and lit the lamp, "the year before last about this time, you were, I believe, at a place called Bamangwato, to the north of the Transvaal." "I was," I answered, rather surprised that this gentleman should be so well acquainted with my movements, which were not, so far as I was aware, considered of general interest. "You were trading there, were you not?" put in Captain Good, in his quick way. "I was. I took up a wagon load of goods, made a camp outside the settlement, and stopped till I had sold them." Sir Henry was sitting opposite to me in a Madeira chair, his arms leaning on the table. He now looked up, fixing his large grey eyes full upon my face. There was a curious anxiety in them, I thought. "Did you happen to meet a man called Neville there?" "Oh, yes, he outspanned alongside of me for a fortnight to rest his oxen before going on to the interior. I had a letter from a lawyer a few months back, asking me if I knew what had become of him, which I answered to the best of my ability at the time." "Yes," said Sir Henry, "your letter was forwarded to me. You said in it that the gentleman called Neville left Bamangwato at the beginning of May in a wagon with a driver, a voorlooper, and a Kaffir hunter called Jim, announcing his intention of trekking if possible as far as Inyati, the extreme trading post in the Matabele country, where he would sell his wagon and proceed on foot. You also said that he did sell his wagon. For 6 months afterwards you saw the wagon in the possession of a Portuguese trader, who told you that he had bought it at Inyati from a white man whose name he had forgotten, and that he believed the white man with the native servant had started off for the interior on a shooting trip." "Yes." Then came a pause. "Mr. Quatermain," said Sir Henry suddenly, "I suppose you know or can guess nothing more of the reasons of my of Mr. Neville's journey to the northward, or as to what point that journey was directed?" "I heard something," I answered, and stopped. The subject was one which I did not care to discuss. Sir Henry and Captain Good looked at each other, and Captain Good nodded. "Mr. Quatermain," went on the former, "I am going to tell you a story, and ask your advice, and perhaps your assistance. The agent who forwarded me your letter told me that I might rely on it implicitly, as you were, he said, well known and universally respected in Natal, and especially noted for your discretion." I bowed and drank some whiskey and water to hide my confusion. "For I am a modest man," and Sir Henry went on. "Mr. Neville was my brother." "Oh," I said, starting, for now I knew of whom Sir Henry had reminded me when first I saw him. His brother was a much smaller man and had a dark beard, but now that I thought of it, he possessed eyes of the same shade of grey and with the same keen look in them, the features too were not unlike. "He was," went on Sir Henry, "my only and younger brother, and till 5 years ago I do not suppose that we were ever a month away from each other. But just about 5 years ago a misfortune befell us, as sometimes does happen in families. We quarreled bitterly, and I behaved unjustly to my brother in my anger." Here Captain Good nodded his head vigorously to himself. The ship gave a big roll just then, so that the looking glass, which was fixed opposite us to starboard, was for a moment nearly over our heads, and as I was sitting with my hands in my pockets and staring upwards, I could see him nodding like anything. "As I dare say you know," went on Sir Henry, "if a man dies intestate, and has no property but land, real property it is called in England, it all descends to his eldest son. It so happened that just at the time when we quarreled our father died intestate. He had put off making his will until it was too late. The result was that my brother, who had not been brought up to any profession, was left without a penny. Of course it would have been my duty to provide for him, but at the time the quarrel between us was so bitter that I did know to my shame I say it," and he sighed deeply, offered to do anything. It was not that I grudged him justice, but I waited for him to make advances, and he made none. I am sorry to trouble you with all this, Mr. Quatermain, but I must to make things clear, eh, good?
Quite so, said the captain.
Mr. Quatermain will, I am sure, keep this history to himself.
Of course, said I, for I rather pride myself on my discretion, for which, as Sir Henry had heard, I have some repute.
Well, one on Sir Henry, my brother had a few £100 to his account at the time. Without saying anything to me he drew out this paltry sum, and, having adopted the name of Neville, started off for South Africa in the wild hope of making a fortune. This I learn afterwards. Some 3 years passed, and I heard nothing of my brother, though I wrote several times. Doubtless the letters never reached him. But as time went on I grew more and more troubled about him. I found out, Mr. Quatermain, that blood is thicker than water.
That's true, said I, thinking of my boy Harry.
I found out, Mr. Quatermain, that I would have given half my fortune to know that my brother George, the only relation I possess, was safe and well, and that I should see him again.
But you never did, Curtis, jerked out Captain Good, glancing at the big man's face.
Well, Mr. Quatermain, as time went on I became more and more anxious to find out if my brother was alive or dead, and if alive to get him home again. I set inquiries on foot, and your letter was one of the results. So far as it went it was satisfactory, for it showed that till lately George was alive, but it did not go far enough. So, to cut a long story short, I made up my mind to come out and look for him myself, and Captain Good was so kind as to come with me.
Yes, said the captain, nothing else to do, you see. Turned out by my lords of the Admiralty to starve on half pay. And now perhaps, sir, you will tell us what you know or have heard of the gentleman called Neville.
Chapter 2. The Legend of Solomon's Mines.
What was it that you heard about my brother's journey at Bamangwato?
Asked Sir Henry, as I paused to fill my pipe before replying to Captain Good.
I heard this, I answered, and I have never mentioned it to a soul till today.
I heard that he was starting for Solomon's Mines.
Solomon's Mines? Ejaculated both my hearers at once. Where are they?
I don't know, I said, I know where they are said to be. Once I saw the peaks of the mountains that border them, but there were 130 miles of desert between me and them, and I am not aware that any white man ever got across it save one. But perhaps the best thing I can do is to tell you the legend of Solomon's Mines as I know it, you passing your word not to reveal anything I tell you without my permission. Do you agree to that? I have my reasons for asking.
Sir Henry nodded, and Captain Good replied, certainly, certainly.
Well, I began, as you may guess, generally speaking, elephant hunters are a rough set of men, who do not trouble themselves with much beyond the facts of life and the ways of Kaffirs. But here and there you meet a man who takes the trouble to collect traditions from the natives, and tries to make out a little piece of the history of this dark land. It was such a man as this who first told me the legend of Solomon's Mines, now a matter of nearly 30 years ago. That was when I was on my first elephant hunt in the Matabele country. His name was Evans, and he was killed the following year, poor fellow, by a wounded buffalo, and lies buried near the Zambezi Falls. I was telling Evans one night, I remember, of some wonderful workings I had found whilst hunting kudu and eland in what is now the Lydenburg district of the Transvaal. I see they have come across these workings again lately in prospecting for gold, but I knew of them years ago. There is a great wide wagon road cut out of the solid rock, and leading to the mouth of the working ore gallery. Inside the mouth of this gallery are stacks of gold quartz piled up ready for roasting, which shows that the workers, whoever they were, must have left in a hurry. Also, about 20 paces in, the gallery is built across, and a beautiful bit of masonry it is.
Eh, said Evans, but I will spin you a queerer yarn than that, and he went on to tell me how he had found in the far interior a ruined city, which he believed to be the Ophir of the Bible, and, by the way, other more learned men have said the same long since poor Evans's time. I was, I remember, listening open-eared to all these wonders, for I was young at the time, and this story of an ancient civilization and of the treasures which those old Jewish or Phoenician adventurers used to extract from a country long since lapsed into the darkest barbarism took a great hold upon my imagination, when suddenly he said to me, lad, did you ever hear of the Suleiman Mountains up to the northwest of the Mushakalumwe country? I told him I never had.
Ah, well, he said, that is where Solomon really had his mines, his diamond mines, I mean.
How do you know that? I asked.
Know it. Why, what is Suleiman but a corruption of Solomon? Besides,
An old Isanusi or witch doctoress up in the Manika country told me all about it. She said that the people who lived across those mountains were a branch of the Zulus, speaking a dialect of Zulu, but finer and bigger men even, that there lived among them great wizards, who had learnt their art from white men when all the world was dark, and who had the secret of a wonderful mine of bright stones. Well, I laughed at this story at the time, though it interested me, for the diamond fields were not discovered then, but poor Evans went off and was killed, and for 20 years I never thought any more of the matter. However, just 20 years afterwards, and that is a long time, gentlemen, an elephant hunter does not often live for 20 years at his business, I heard something more definite about Suleiman's Mountains and the country which lies beyond them. I was up beyond the Manika country, at a place called Saitanda's Kraal, and a miserable place it was, for a man could get nothing to eat, and there was but little game about. I had an attack of fever, and was in a bad way generally, when one day a Portuguese arrived with a single companion, a half-breed. Now I know your low-class Delagoa Portuguese well. There is no greater devil unhung in a general way, battening as he does upon human agony and flesh in the shape of slaves. But this was quite a different type of man to the mean fellows whom I had been accustomed to meet. Indeed, in appearance he reminded me more of the polite Doms I have read about, for he was tall and thin, with large dark eyes and curling grey mustachios. We talked together for a while, for he could speak broken English, and I understood a little Portuguese, and he told me that his name was José Silvestre, and that he had a place near Delagoa Bay. When he went on next day with his half-breed companion, he said goodbye, taking off his hat quite in the old style. "Goodbye, senor," he said, "if ever we meet again I shall be the richest man in the world, and I will remember you." I laughed a little, I was too weak to laugh much, and watched him strike out for the great desert to the west, wondering if he was mad, or what he thought he was going to find there. A week passed, and I got the better of my fever. One evening I was sitting on the ground in front of the little tent I had with me, chewing the last leg of a miserable fowl I had bought from a native for a bit of cloth worth 20 fowls, and staring at the hot red sun sinking down over the desert, when suddenly I saw a figure, apparently that of a European, for it wore a coat, on the slope of the rising ground opposite to me, about 300 yards away. The figure crept along on its hands and knees, then it got up and staggered forward a few yards on its legs, only to fall and crawl again. Seeing that it must be somebody in distress, I sent one of my hunters to help him, and presently he arrived, and who do you suppose it turned out to be? José Silvestre, of course, said Captain Good. Yes, José Silvestre, or rather his skeleton and a little skin. His face was a bright yellow with bilious fever, and his large dark eyes stood nearly out of his head, for all the flesh had gone. There was nothing but yellow parchment-like skin, white hair, and the gaunt bones sticking up beneath. Water! For the sake of Christ, water! He moaned, and I saw that his lips were cracked, and his tongue, which protruded between them, was swollen and blackish. I gave him water with a little milk in it, and he drank it in great gulps, 2 quarts or so, without stopping. I would not let him have any more. Then the fever took him again, and he fell down and began to rave about Suleiman's Mountains, and the diamonds, and the desert. I carried him into the tent and did what I could for him, which was little enough, but I saw how it must end. About 11 o'clock he grew quieter, and I lay down for a little rest and went to sleep. At dawn I woke again, and in the half-light saw Silvestre sitting up, a strange, gaunt form, and gazing out towards the desert. Presently the first ray of the sun shot right across the wide plain before us till it reached the faraway crest of one of the tallest of the Suleiman Mountains more than 100 miles away. "There it is," cried the dying man in Portuguese, and pointing with his long, thin arm, "but I shall never reach it, never. No one will ever reach it." Suddenly, he paused, and seemed to take a resolution. "Friend," he said, turning towards me, "are you there? My eyes grow dark." "Yes," I said, "yes, lie down now, and rest." "Eh," he answered, "I shall rest soon, I have time to rest till eternity. Listen, I am dying. You have been good to me. I will give you the writing. Perhaps you will get there if you can live to pass the desert, which has killed my poor servant and me." Then he groped in his shirt and brought out what I thought was a Boer tobacco pouch made of the skin of the swart witpans or sable antelope. It was fastened with a little strip of hide, what we call a rimpi, and this he tried to loose, but could not. He handed it to me. "Untie it," he said. I did so, and extracted a bit of torn yellow linen on which something was written in rusty letters. Inside this rag was a paper. Then he went on feebly, for he was growing weak, "the paper has all that is on the linen. It took me years to read. Listen, my ancestor, a political refugee from Lisbon, and one of the first Portuguese who landed on these shores, wrote that when he was dying on those mountains which no white foot ever pressed before or since. His name was José da Silvestra, and he lived 300 years ago. His slave, who waited for him on this side of the mountains, found him dead, and brought the writing home to Delagoa. It has been in the family ever since, but none have cared to read it, till at last I did. And I have lost my life over it, but another may succeed, and become the richest man in the world, the richest man in the world. Only give it to no one, senor, go yourself. Then he began to wander again, and in an hour it was all over. God rest him. He died very quietly, and I buried him deep, with big boulders on his breast, so I do not think that the jackals can have dug him up. And then I came away.
Eh, but the document? Said Sir Henry, in a tone of deep interest.
Yes, the document, what was in it? Added the captain.
Well, gentlemen, if you like I will tell you. I have never showed it to anybody yet except to a drunken old Portuguese trader who translated it for me, and had forgotten all about it by the next morning. The original rag is at my home in Durban, together with poor Dom José's translation, but I have the English rendering in my pocketbook, and a facsimile of the map, if it can be called a map. Here it is.
I, José da Silvestra, who am now dying of hunger in the little cave where no snow is on the north side of the nipple of the southernmost of the two mountains I have named Sheba's Breasts, write this in the year 1590 with a cleft bone upon a remnant of my raiment, my blood being the ink. If my slave should find it when he comes, and should bring it to Delagoa, let my friend, name illegible, bring the matter to the knowledge of the king, that he may send an army which, if they live through the desert and the mountains, and can overcome the brave Kakwanis and their devilish arts, to which end many priests should be brought, will make him the richest king since Solomon. With my own eyes I have seen the countless diamonds stored in Solomon's treasure chamber behind the White Death, but through the treachery of Gagool the witch finder I might bring not away, scarcely my life. Let him who comes follow the map, and climb the snow of Sheba's left breast till he reaches the nipple, on the north side of which is the great road Solomon made, from whence 3 days' journey to the king's palace. Let him kill Gagool. Pray for my soul. Farewell. José da Silvestra. When I had finished reading the above, and shown the copy of the map, drawn by the dying hand of the old Dom with his blood for ink, there followed a silence of astonishment.
Well, said Captain Good, I have been round the world twice, and put in at most ports, but may I be hung for a mutineer if ever I heard a yarn like this out of a storybook, or in it either, for the matter of that.
It's a queer tale, Mr. Quatermain, said Sir Henry. I suppose you are not hoaxing us?
It is, I know, sometimes thought allowable to take in a greenhorn.
If you think that, Sir Henry, I said, much put out, and pocketing my paper for I do not like to be thought one of those silly fellows who consider it witty to tell lies, and who are forever boasting to newcomers of extraordinary hunting adventures which never happened if you think that, why, there is an end to the matter, and I rose to go.
Sir Henry laid his large hand upon my shoulder.
Sit down, Mr. Quatermain, he said, I beg your pardon. I see very well you do not wish to deceive us, but the story sounded so strange that I could hardly believe it.
You shall see the original map and writing when we reach Durban, I answered, somewhat mollified, for really when I came to consider the question it was scarcely wonderful that he should doubt my good faith.
But, I went on, I have not told you about your brother. I knew the man Jim who was with him. He was a Bechuana by birth, a good hunter, and for a native a very clever man. That morning on which Mr. Neville was starting I saw Jim standing by my wagon and cutting up tobacco on the Disselboom.
Jim, said I, where are you off to this trip? It is elephants?
No, Buzz, he answered, we are after something worth much more than ivory.
And what might that be?
I said, for I was curious.
Is it gold?
No, Buzz, something worth more than gold, and he grinned. I asked no more questions, for I did not like to lower my dignity by seeming inquisitive, but I was puzzled. Presently Jim finished cutting his tobacco.
Boz, said he.
I took no notice.
Boz, said he again.
Eh, boy, what is it?
I asked.
Boz, we are going after diamonds.
Diamonds?
Why, then, you are steering in the wrong direction, you should head for the fields.
Boz, have you ever heard of Suleiman's Berg? That is, Solomon's Mountains, Sir Henry.
Eh.
Have you ever heard of the diamonds there?
I have heard a foolish story, Jim.
It is no story, Boz. Once I knew a woman who came from there, and reached Natal with her child, she told me, she is dead now.
Your master will feed the Svugels, that is, vultures, Jim, if he tries to reach Suleiman's country, and so will you if they can get any pickings off your worthless old carcass, said I. He grinned. Mayhap, Boz. Man must die, I'd rather like to try a new country myself, the elephants are getting worked out about here. Ah. My boy, I said, you wait till the pale old man gets a grip of your yellow throat, and then we shall hear what sort of a tune you sing. Half an hour after that I saw Neville's wagon move off. Presently Jim came back running. Goodbye, Boz, he said. I didn't like to start without bidding you goodbye, for I dare say you are right, and that we shall never trek south again. Is your master really going to Suleiman's Burg, Jim, or are you lying? No, he answered, he is going. He told me he was bound to make his fortune somehow, or try to, so he might as well have a fling for the diamonds. Oh. I said, wait a bit, Jim, will you take an oath to your master, Jim, and promise not to give it to him till you reach Inyadi? Which was some 100 miles off. Yes, Boz. So I took a scrap of paper, and wrote on it, let him who comes. Climb the snow of Sheba's left breast, till he reaches the nipple, on the north side of which is Solomon's great road. Now, Jim, I said, when you give this to your master, tell him he had better follow the advice on it implicitly. You are not to give it to him now, because I don't want him back asking me questions which I won't answer. Now be off, you idle fellow, the wagon is nearly out of sight. Jim took the note and went, and that is all I know about your brother, Sir Henry, but I am much afraid. Mr. Quatermain, said Sir Henry, I am going to look for my brother, I am going to trace him to Suleiman's mountains, and over them if necessary, till I find him, or until I know that he is dead. Will you come with me? I am, as I think I have said, a cautious man, indeed a timid one, and this suggestion frightened me. It seemed to me that to undertake such a journey would be to go to certain death, and putting other considerations aside, as I had a son to support, I could not afford to die just then. No, thank you, Sir Henry, I think I had rather not, I answered. I am too old for wild goose chases of that sort, and we should only end up like my poor friend Silvestre. I have a son dependent on me, so I cannot afford to risk my life foolishly. Both Sir Henry and Captain Good looked very disappointed. Mr. Quatermain, said the former, I am well off, and I am bent upon this business. You may put the remuneration for your services at whatever figure you like in reason, and it shall be paid over to you before we start. Moreover, I will arrange in the event of anything untoward happening to us or to you, that your son shall be suitably provided for. You will see from this offer how necessary I think your presence. Also, if by chance we should reach this place, and find diamonds, they shall belong to you and Good equally. I do not want them. But of course that promise is worth nothing at all, though the same thing would apply to any ivory we might get. You may pretty well make your own terms with me, Mr. Quatermain, and of course I shall pay all expenses. Sir Henry, said I, this is the most liberal proposal I ever had, and one not to be sneezed at by a poor hunter and trader. But the job is the biggest I have come across, and I must take time to think it over. I will give you my answer before we get to Durban. Very good, answered Sir Henry. Then I said good night and turned in, and dreamt about poor long dead Silvestre and the diamonds. Chapter 3. Umbopa enters our service. It takes from 4 to 5 days, according to the speed of the vessel and the state of the weather, to run up from the Cape to Durban. Sometimes, if the landing is bad at East London, where they have not yet made that wonderful harbor they talk so much of, and sink such a mint of money in, a ship is delayed for 24 hours before the cargo boats can get out to take off the goods. But on this occasion we had not to wait at all, for there were no breakers on the bar to speak of, and the tugs came out at once with the long strings of ugly flat-bottomed boats behind them, into which the packages were bundled with a crash. It did not matter what they might be, over they went slap-bang, whether they contained china or woolen goods they met with the same treatment. I saw one case holding 4 dozen of champagne smashed all to bits, and there was the champagne fizzing and boiling about in the bottom of the dirty cargo boat. It was a wicked waste, and evidently so the Kaffirs in the boat thought, for they found a couple of unbroken bottles, and knocking off the next drank the contents. But they had not allowed for the expansion caused by the fizz in the wine, and, feeling themselves swelling, rolled about in the bottom of the boat, calling out that the good liquor was tagati, that is, bewitched. I spoke to them from the vessel, and told them it was the white man's strongest medicine, and that they were as good as dead men. Those Kaffirs went to the shore in a very great fright, and I do not think that they will touch champagne again. Well, all the time that we were steaming up to Natal I was thinking over Sir Henry Curtis's offer. We did not speak any more on the subject for a day or two, though I told them many hunting yarns, all true ones. There is no need to tell lies about hunting, for so many curious things happen within the knowledge of a man whose business it is to hunt, but this is by the way. At last, one beautiful evening in January, which is our hottest month, we steamed past the coast of Natal, expecting to make Durban Point by sunset. It is a lovely coast all along from East London, with its red sandhills and wide sweeps of vivid green, dotted here and there with Kaffir kraals, and bordered by a ribbon of white surf, which spouts up in pillars of foam where it hits the rocks. But just before you come to Durban there is a peculiar richness about the landscape. There are the sheer kloofs cut in the hills by the rushing rains of centuries, down which the rivers sparkle, there is the deepest green of the bush, growing as God planted it, and the other greens of the mealy gardens and the sugar patches, while now and again a white house, smiling out at the placid sea, puts a finish and gives an air of homeliness to the scene. For to my mind, however beautiful a view may be, it requires the presence of man to make it complete, but perhaps that is because I have lived so much in the wilderness, and therefore know the value of civilization, though to be sure it drives away the game. The Garden of Eden, no doubt, looked fair before man was, but I always think that it must have been fairer when Eve adorned it. To return, we had miscalculated a little, and the sun was well down before we dropped anchor off the point, and heard the gun which told the good folks of Durban that the English mail was in. It was too late to think of getting over the bar that night, so we went comfortably to dinner, after seeing the mails carried off in the lifeboat. When we came up again the moon was out, and shining so brightly over sea and shore that she almost paled the quick, large flashes from the lighthouse. From the shore floated sweet spicy odors that always remind me of hymns and missionaries, and in the windows of the houses on the Berea sparkled 100 lights. From a large brig lying near also came the music of the sailors as they worked at getting the anchor up in order to be ready for the wind. Altogether it was a perfect night, such a night as you sometimes get in southern Africa, and it threw a garment of peace over everybody as the moon threw a garment of silver over everything. Even the great bulldog, belonging to a sporting passenger, seemed to yield to its gentle influences, and forgetting his yearning to come to close quarters with the baboon in a cage on the forecastle, snored happily at the door of the cabin, dreaming no doubt that he had finished him, and happy in his dream. We three, that is, Sir Henry Curtis, Captain Good, and myself, went and sat by the wheel, and were quiet for a while. "Well, Mr. Quatermain," said Sir Henry presently, "have you been thinking about my proposals?" "Eh," echoed Captain Good, "what do you think of them, Mr. Quatermain? I hope that you are going to give us the pleasure of your company so far as Solomon's Mines, or wherever the gentleman you knew as Neville may have got to." I rose and knocked out my pipe before I answered. I had not made up my mind, and wanted an additional moment to decide. Before the burning tobacco had fallen into the sea I had decided, just that little extra second did the trick. It is often the way when you have been bothering a long time over a thing. "Yes, gentlemen," I said, sitting down again, "I will go, and by your leave I will tell you why, and on what conditions. First for the terms which I ask. 1. You are to pay all expenses, and any ivory or other valuables we may get is to be divided between Captain Good and myself. 2. That you give me £500 for my services on the trip before we start, I undertaking to serve you faithfully till you choose to abandon the enterprise, or till we succeed, or disaster overtakes us. 3. That before we trek you execute a deed agreeing, in the event of my death or disablement, to pay my boy Harry, who is studying medicine over there in London, at Guy's Hospital, a sum of £200 a year for 5 years, by which time he ought to be able to earn a living for himself if he is worth his salt. That is all, I think, and I dare say you will say quiet enough too." "No," answered Sir Henry, "I accept them gladly. I am bent upon this project, and would pay more than that for your help, considering the peculiar and exclusive knowledge which you possess." "Pity I did not ask it, then, but I won't go back on my word. And now that I have got my terms I will tell you my reasons for making up my mind to go. First of all, gentlemen, I have been observing you both for the last few days, and if you will not think me impertinent I may say that I like you, and believe that we shall come up well to the yoke together. That is something, let me tell you, when one has a long journey like this before one. And now as to the journey itself, I tell you flatly, Sir Henry and Captain Good, that I do not think it probable we can come out of it alive, that is, if we attempt to cross the Suliman Mountains. What was the fate of the old Dom de Silvestre 300 years ago? What was the fate of his descendant 20 years ago? What has been your brother's fate? I tell you frankly, gentlemen, that as their fates were so I believe ours will be. I paused to watch the effect of my words. Captain Good looked a little uncomfortable, but Sir Henry's face did not change. "We must take our chance," he said. "You may perhaps wonder," I went on, "why, if I think this, I, who am, as I told you, a timid man, should undertake such a journey. It is for two reasons. First, I am a fatalist, and believe that my time is appointed to come quiet without reference to my own movements and will, and that if I am to go to Suleiman's Mountains to be killed, I shall go there and shall be killed. God Almighty, no doubt, knows his mind about me, so I need not trouble on that point. Secondly, I am a poor man. For nearly 40 years I have hunted and traded, but I have never made more than a living. Well, gentlemen, I don't know if you are aware that the average life of an elephant hunter from the time he takes to the trade is between 4 and 5 years. So you see, I have lived through about 7 generations of my class, and I should think that my time cannot be far off, anyway. Now, if anything were to happen to me in the ordinary course of business, by the time my debts are paid there would be nothing left to support my son Harry whilst he was getting in the way of earning a living, whereas now he will be set up for 5 years. There is the whole affair in a nutshell. Mr. Quatermain, said Sir Henry, who had been giving me his most serious attention, your motives for undertaking an enterprise which you believe can only end in disaster reflect a great deal of credit on you. Whether or not you are right, of course time and the event alone can show. But whether you are right or wrong, I may as well tell you at once that I am going through with it to the end, sweet or bitter. If we are to be knocked on the head, all I have to say is, that I hope we get a little shooting first, eh, Good? Yes, yes, put in the captain. We have all three of us been accustomed to face danger, and to hold our lives in our hands in various ways, so it is no good turning back now. And now I vote we go down to the saloon and take an observation just for luck, you know. And we did through the bottom of a tumbler. Next day we went ashore, and I put up Sir Henry and Captain Good at the little shanty I have built on the Berea, and which I call my home. There are only 3 rooms and a kitchen in it, and it is constructed of green brick with a galvanized iron roof, but there is a good garden with the best loquat trees in it that I know, and some nice young mangoes, of which I hope great things. The curator of the botanical gardens gave them to me. It is looked after by an old hunter of mine named Jack, whose thigh was so badly broken by a buffalo cow in Sikokunas country that he will never hunt again. But he can potter about and garden, being a Greek by birth. You will never persuade a Zulu to take much interest in gardening. It is a peaceful art, and peaceful arts are not in his line. Sir Henry and Good slept in a tent pitched in my little grove of orange trees at the end of the garden, for there was no room for them in the house, and what with the smell of the bloom, and the sight of the green and golden fruit in Durban you will see all three on the tree together. I dare say it is a pleasant place enough, for we have few mosquitoes here on the Berea, unless there happens to come an unusually heavy rain. Well, to get on, for if I do not, Harry, you will be tired of my story before ever we fetch up at Suleiman's Mountains. Having once made up my mind to go, I set about making the necessary preparations. First I secured the deed from Sir Henry, providing for you, my boy, in case of accidents. There was some difficulty about its legal execution, as Sir Henry was a stranger here, and the property to be charged is over the water, but it was ultimately got over with the help of a lawyer, who charged £20 for the job, a price that I thought outrageous. Then I pocketed my check for £500. Having paid this tribute to my bump of caution, I purchased a wagon and a span of oxen on Sir Henry's behalf, and beauties they were. It was a 22-foot wagon with iron axles, very strong, very light, and built throughout of stinkwood, not quite a new one, having been to the diamond fields and back, but, in my opinion, all the better for that, for I could see that the wood was well seasoned. If anything is going to give in a wagon, or if there is green wood in it, it will show out on the first trip. This particular vehicle was what we call a half-tented wagon, that is to say, only covered in over the after 12 feet, leaving all the front part free for the necessaries we had to carry with us. In this after part were a hide cartel, or bed, on which 2 people could sleep, also racks for rifles, and many other little conveniences. I gave £125 for it, and think that it was cheap at the price. Then I bought a beautiful team of 20 Zulu oxen, which I had kept my eye on for a year or two. 16 oxen is the usual number for a team, but I took 4 extra to allow for casualties. These Zulu cattle are small and light, not more than half the size of the African Deer oxen, which are generally used for transport purposes, but they will live where the Africanders would starve, and with a moderate load can make 5 miles a day better going, being quicker and not so liable to become footsore. What is more, this lot were thoroughly salted, that is, they had worked all over South Africa, and so had become proof, comparatively speaking, against red water, which so frequently destroys whole teams of oxen when they get onto strange veldt or grass country. As for lung sick, which is a dreadful form of pneumonia, very prevalent in this country, they had all been inoculated against it. This is done by cutting a slit in the tail of an ox, and binding in a piece of the diseased lung of an animal which has died of the sickness. The result is that the ox sickens, takes the disease in a mild form, which causes its tail to drop off, as a rule about a foot from the root, and becomes proof against future attacks. It seems cruel to rob the animal of his tail, especially in a country where there are so many flies, but it is better to sacrifice the tail and keep the ox than to lose both tail and ox, for a tail without an ox is not much good, except to dust with. Still it does look odd to trek along behind 20 stumps, where there ought to be tails. It seems as though nature made a trifling mistake, and stuck the stern ornaments of a lot of prize bulldogs onto the rumps of the oxen. Next came the question of provisioning and medicines, one which required the most careful consideration, for what we had to do was to avoid lumbering the wagon, and yet to take everything absolutely necessary. Fortunately, it turned out that Good is a bit of a doctor, having at some point in his previous career managed to pass through a course of medical and surgical instruction, which he has more or less kept up. He is not, of course, qualified, but he knows more about it than many a man who can write MD after his name, as we found out afterwards, and he had a splendid traveling medicine chest and a set of instruments. Whilst we were at Durban he cut off a Kaffir's big toe in a way which it was a pleasure to see. But he was quite nonplussed when the Kaffir, who had sat stolidly watching the operation, asked him to put on another, saying that a white one would do at a pinch. There remained, when these questions were satisfactorily settled, two further important points for consideration, namely, that of arms and that of servants. As to the arms, I cannot do better than put down a list of those which we finally decided on from among the ample store that Sir Henry had brought with him from England, and those which I owned. I copy it from my pocketbook, where I made the entry at the time. 3 heavy breech-loading double-A8 elephant guns, weighing about 15 pounds each, to carry a charge of 11 drams of black powder. 2 of these were by a well-known London firm, most excellent makers, but I do not know by whom mine, which is not so highly finished, was made. I have used it on several trips, and shot a good many elephants with it, and it has always proved a most superior weapon, thoroughly to be relied on. 3 double 500 expresses, constructed to stand a charge of 6 drams, sweet weapons, and admirable for medium-sized game, such as eland or sable antelope, or for men, especially in an open country and with a semi-hollow bullet. 1 double number 12 central firekeeper's shotgun, full choke both barrels. This gun proved of the greatest service to us afterwards in shooting game for the pot. 3 Winchester repeating rifles, not carbines, spare guns. 3 single-action Colt's revolvers, with the heavier, or American pattern of cartridge. This was our total armament, and doubtless the reader will observe that the weapons of each class were of the same make and caliber, so that the cartridges were interchangeable, a very important point. I make no apology for detailing it at length, as every experienced hunter will know how vital a proper supply of guns and ammunition is to the success of an expedition. Now as to the men who were to go with us. After much consultation we decided that their number should be limited to 5, namely, a driver, a leader, and 3 servants. The driver and leader I found without much difficulty, 2 Zulus, named respectively Goza and Tom, but to get the servants proved a more difficult matter. It was necessary that they should be thoroughly trustworthy and brave men, as in a business of this sort our lives might depend upon their conduct. At last I secured 2, one a Hottentot named Van Vogel, or Windbird, and 1 a little Zulu named Kiva, who had the merit of speaking English perfectly. Van Vogel I had known before, he was one of the most perfect spoorers, that is, game trackers, I ever had to do with, and tough as whipcord. He never seemed to tire. But he had one failing, so common with his race, drink. Put him within reach of a bottle of gin and you could not trust him. However, as we are going beyond the region of grog shops, this little weakness of his did not so much matter. Having secured these 2 men, I looked in vain for a 3rd to suit my purpose, so we determined to start without 1, trusting to luck to find a suitable man on our way up country. But, as it happened, on the evening before the day we had fixed for our departure, the Zulu Kiva informed me that a Kaffir was waiting to see me. Accordingly, when we had done dinner, for we were at table at the time, I told Kiva to bring him in. Presently a tall, handsome-looking man, somewhere about 30 years of age, and very light-colored for a Zulu, entered, and lifting his knobstick by way of salute, squatted himself down in the corner on his haunches, and sat silent. I did not take any notice of him for a while, for it is a great mistake to do so. If you rush into conversation at once, a Zulu is apt to think you a person of little dignity or consequence. I observed, however, that he was a Kishla or ringed man, that is, he wore on his head the black ring, made of a species of gum polished with fat and worked up in the hair, which is usually assumed by Zulus on attaining a certain age or dignity. Also it struck me that his face was familiar to me. "Well," I said at last, "what is your name?"
"Umbopa," answered the man in a slow, deep voice.
"I have seen your face before."
"Yes, the Inkoosi, the chief, my father, saw my face at the place of the little hand that is, Isondlwana on the day before the battle." Then I remembered. I was one of Lord Chelmsford's guides in that unlucky Zulu war, and had the good fortune to leave the camp in charge of some wagons on the day before the battle. While I was waiting for the cattle to be inspanned, I fell into conversation with this man, who held some small command among the native auxiliaries, and he had expressed to me his doubts as to the safety of the camp. At the time I told him to hold his tongue, and leave such matters to wiser heads, but afterwards I thought of his words.
"I remember," I said, "what is it you want?"
"It is this, Macumazahn. That is my Kaffir name, and means the man who gets up in the middle of the night, or, in vulgar English, he who keeps his eyes open. I hear that you go on a great expedition far into the north with the white chiefs from over the water. Is it a true word?"
"It is."
"I hear that you go even to the Lukanga River, a moon's journey beyond the Manika country. Is this so also, Macumazahn?"
"Why do you ask whither we go? What is it to you?"
I answered suspiciously, for the objects of our journey had been kept a dead secret.
"It is this, O white men, that if indeed you travel so far I would travel with you." There was a certain assumption of dignity in the man's mode of speech, and especially in his use of the words "O white men," instead of "O Inkosis," or chiefs, which struck me.
"You forget yourself a little," I said. "Your words run out unawares. That is not the way to speak. What is your name, and where is your kraal? Tell us, that we may know with whom we have to deal."
"My name is Umbopa. I am of the Zulu people, yet not of them. The house of my tribe is in the far north. It was left behind when the Zulus came down here 1,000 years ago, long before Chaka reigned in Zululand. I have no kraal. I have wandered for many years. I came from the north as a child to Zululand. I was Kedawayo's man in the Nkama Bakosi regiment, serving there under the great captain, Umslopagasi of the Axe, who taught my hands to fight. Afterwards I ran away from Zululand and came to Natal because I wanted to see the white man's ways. Next I fought against Gedawayo in the war. Since then I have been working in Natal. Now I am tired, and would go north again. Here is not my place. I want no money, but I am a brave man, and am worth my place and meat. I have spoken." I was rather puzzled by this man and his way of speech. It was evident to me from his manner that in the main he was telling the truth, but somehow he seemed different from the ordinary run of Zulus, and I rather mistrusted his offer to come without pay. Being in a difficulty, I translated his words to Sir Henry and Good, and asked them their opinion. Sir Henry told me to ask him to stand up. Umbopa did so, at the same time slipping off the long military greatcoat which he wore, and revealing himself naked except for the mooch around his center and a necklace of lion's claws. Certainly he was a magnificent-looking man. I never saw a finer native. Standing about 6'3" high, he was broad in proportion, and very shapely. In that light, too, his skin looked scarcely more than dark, except here and there were deep black scars marked old assegai wounds. Sir Henry walked up to him and looked into his proud, handsome face.
"They make a good pair, don't they?" said Good. "One as big as the other."
"I like your looks, Mr. Umbopa, and I will take you as my servant," said Sir Henry in English. Umbopa evidently understood him, for he answered in Zulu, "It is well," and then added, with a glance at the white man's great stature and breadth, "We are men, thou and I." Chapter 4. An Elephant Hunt. Now I do not propose to narrate at full length all the incidents of our long travel up to Sitanda's kraal, near the junction of the Lukanga and Kalukoi rivers. It was a journey of more than 1,000 miles from Durban, the last 300 or so of which we had to make on foot, owing to the frequent presence of the dreadful tsetse fly, whose bite is fatal to all animals except donkeys and men. We left Durban at the end of January, and it was in the second week of May that we camped near Sitanda's kraal. Our adventures on the way were many and various, but as they are of the sort which befall every African hunter with one exception to be presently detailed, I shall not set them down here, lest I should render this history too wearisome. At Inyati, the outlying trading station in the Matabele country, of which Labangula, a great and cruel scoundrel, is king, With many regrets we parted from our comfortable wagon. Only 12 oxen remained to us out of the beautiful span of 20 which I had bought at Durban. One we lost from the bite of a cobra, 3 had perished from poverty and the want of water, 1 strayed, and the other 3 died from eating the poisonous herb called tulip. 5 more sickened from this cause, but we managed to cure them with doses of an infusion made by boiling down the tulip leaves. If administered in time, this is a very effective antidote. The wagon and the oxen we left in the immediate charge of Goza and Tom, our driver and leader, both trustworthy boys, requesting a worthy Scotch missionary who lived in this distant place to keep an eye on them. Then, accompanied by Umbopa, Kiva, Ventvogel, and half a dozen bearers whom we hired on the spot, we started off on foot upon our wild quest. I remember we were all a little silent on the occasion of this departure, and I think that each of us was wondering if we should ever see our wagon again. For my part, I never expected to do so. For a while we tramped on in silence, till Umbopa, who was marching in front, broke into a Zulu chant about how some brave men, tired of life and the tameness of things, started off into a vast wilderness to find new things or die, and how, lo and behold, when they had traveled far into the wilderness they found that it was not a wilderness at all, but a beautiful place full of young wives and fat cattle, of game to hunt and enemies to kill. Then we all laughed and took it for a good omen. Umbopa was a cheerful savage, in a dignified sort of way, when he was not suffering from one of his fits of brooding, and he had a wonderful knack of keeping up our spirits. We all grew very fond of him. And now for the one adventure to which I am going to treat myself, for I do dearly love a hunting yarn. About a fortnight's march from Inyati we came across a peculiarly beautiful bit of well-watered woodland country. The kloofs in the hills were covered with dense bush, Idoro bush as the natives call it, and in some places, with the Voktane besh, or Wheaton little thorn, and there were great quantities of the lovely McHable tree, laden with refreshing yellow fruit having enormous stones. This tree is the elephant's favorite food, and there were not wanting signs that the great brutes had been about, for not only was their spoor frequent, but in many places the trees were broken down and even uprooted. The elephant is a destructive feeder. One evening, after a long day's march, we came to a spot of great loveliness. At the foot of a bush-clad hill lay a dry riverbed, in which, however, were to be found pools of crystal water all trodden round with the hoofprints of game. Facing this hill was a park-like plain, where grew clumps of flat-topped mimosa, varied with occasional glossy-leaved macabels, and all round stretched the sea of pathless, silent bush. As we emerged into this riverbed path suddenly we started a troop of tall giraffes, who galloped, or rather sailed off, in their strange gait, their tails screwed up over their backs, and their hoofs rattling like castanets. They were about 300 yards from us, and therefore practically out of shot, but Good, who was walking ahead, and who had an express loaded with solid ball in his hand, could not resist temptation. Lifting his gun, he let drive at the last, a young cow. By some extraordinary chance the ball struck it full on the back of the neck, shattering the spinal column, and that giraffe went rolling head over heels just like a rabbit. I never saw a more curious thing. "Curse it," said Good, for I am sorry to say he had a habit of using strong language when excited, contracted, no doubt, in the course of his nautical career, "curse it. I've killed him." _u_Bhagwan, ejaculated the Kaffirs, _u_! They called Good Bhagwan, or Glass Eye, because of his eyeglass. "Oh, Bhagwan," re-echoed Sir Henry and I, and from that day Good's reputation as a marvelous shot was established, at any rate among the Kaffirs. Really he was a bad one, but whenever he missed we overlooked it for the sake of that giraffe. Having set some of the boys to cut off the best of the giraffe's meat, we went to work to build a sherm near one of the pools and about 100 yards to its right. This is done by cutting a quantity of thorn bushes and piling them in the shape of a circular hedge. Then the space enclosed is smoothed, and dry tambuki grass, if obtainable, is made into a bed in the center, and a fire is lighted. By the time the sherm was finished the moon peeped up, and our dinners of giraffe steaks and roasted marrow bones were ready. How we enjoyed those marrow bones, though it was rather a job to crack them. I know of no greater luxury than giraffe marrow, unless it is elephant's heart, and we had that on the morrow. We ate our simple meal by the light of the moon, pausing at times to thank Good for his wonderful shot, then we began to smoke and yarn, and a curious picture we must have made squatting there round the fire. I, with my short grizzled hair sticking up straight, and Sir Henry with his yellow locks, which were getting rather long, were rather a contrast, especially as I am thin, and short, and dark, weighing only 9½ stone, and Sir Henry is tall, and broad, and fair, and weighs 15. But perhaps the most curious looking of the three, taking all the circumstances of the case into consideration, was Captain John Good. And there he sat upon a leather bag, looking just as though he had come in from a comfortable day's shooting in a civilized country, absolutely clean, tidy, and well-dressed. He wore a shooting suit of brown tweed, with a hat to match, and neat gaiters. As usual, he was beautifully shaved, his eyeglass and his false teeth appeared to be in perfect order, and altogether he looked the neatest man I ever had to do with in the wilderness. He even sported a collar, of which he had a supply, made of white gutta percha. "You see, they weigh so little," he said to me innocently, when I expressed my astonishment at the fact, "and I always like to turn out like a gentleman." Ah! If he could have foreseen the future and the raiment prepared for him. Well, there we three sat yarning away in the beautiful moonlight, and watching the Kaffirs a few yards off sucking their intoxicating dhaka from a pipe of which the mouthpiece was made of the horn of an eland, till one by one they rolled themselves up in their blankets and went to sleep